Just what the hell is Bitcoin? Well, one way to describe it is it's a thing that isn't. Make sense? Don't worry about it. Except that you might have to, because Bitcoin might just be the greatest and most valuable absolute nothing in history, or it might just bring down the power grid on its way to crippling the global economy. My guest on Convo this time around says Bitcoin is a high-tech flimflam. Chris Whalen is an investment banker and chairman of Whalen Global Advisors, LLC in New York. He's the author of three books, the latest being Ford Men, From Inspiration to Enterprise, released in 2017. He edits The Institutional Risk Analyst and is a familiar guest on CNBC, Bloomberg, Fox News, and Business News Network. And he is the author of a recent article on Bitcoin for the American Conservative magazine. I have to admit, I love the title, Bitcoin, the Most Impressive Speculative Bubble in Modern History. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
My pleasure.
So, just what the hell is Bitcoin?
Well, Bitcoin is a game that was devised by a technologist. We don't know his or her real name, but he posted this interesting conceptual paper a few years back, and it laid out a way for individuals to exchange value using these tokens called Bitcoins. And the way that this works is that they have a very complex algorithm that relies on industrial-strength cryptography that allows part of the transaction to be visible to the public and part private. So the miners of Bitcoin, you've probably heard that term, have to do some really heavy-duty math calculations to do what's called a proof of work for each transaction to prove it is valid. And then they add that transactional validation to a chain, thus the term blockchain. And it was really a very clever way of dealing with a basic problem, which is he wanted to replicate a face-to-face transaction over the internet with the same level of trust. So in order to do that, they had to have part of it, as I say, open to the public. So every single Bitcoin trade out there is visible in the blockchain. But at the same time, it had to be secure enough so that they could avoid having bad actors come in and try and hack the network. So they had to make it very expensive to clear these trades. In fact, the cost goes up as the price of Bitcoin rises. It's deliberately inefficient. So it's a very strange game. But, you know, if you strip off all of the technological trappings and all of the claims about benefits and how this is a new form of money, it's really just a basic fraud, because you're paying somebody for nothing. You're getting this notional token, if you will, and the only way that you can make or even recover the money you put into it is if somebody out there is willing to pay you at least as much as you paid, the greater fool. So.
Well, the thing that gets me about this is everybody's attention is caught right now, obviously, because there's this sort of, I don't know, Wild West gold rush kind of thing that's happening, this fever surrounding Bitcoin and the growth of it. But the SEC just blocked trading on it for the holiday season. And because they say, you know, it seems like it's being artificially manipulated. The growth has been something like 2,700% or something.
Oh, you mean in the futures contract? Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And well, that was appropriate. There's no connection between the cash price for Bitcoin and the futures contract. You know, one of the most basic components of a futures market is there has to be some connection between the basis of the contract, the cash market, and the futures contract. And here there's none. So I think that's an appropriate decision by the SEC.
Well, I do too, actually, to be honest with you. I'm not so to editorialize necessarily, but I'm glad
no,
they
go
did
ahead.
It. But between you and me, it's fine, yeah. You know, but I mean, the thing about this is the interesting, fascinating thing to me about cryptocurrency itself in general is that it is its own currency, and yet it's measured in actual dollars. But I mean, the thing I don't really understand is, I mean, where do you get it? How do you spend it? I mean, do you spend actual dollars to get it? And what do you do with it? I mean, can I walk into a car dealer and say, here's a Bitcoin, you know, I want a car? And he's going to say, sure. I mean, how do you spend it? I mean,
well, going back to the Civil War, when Abraham Lincoln had to finance the conflict, he issued greenbacks. These were federal currency that actually bore interest. It was like a treasury bond, but they weren't convertible into gold. And in order to make everybody use these pieces of paper, they enacted legal tender laws, which said that these pieces of paper are legal tender for all debts, public and private. So effectively, you're forced to accept it. Now, you don't have to accept Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is not a form of money. It's like I said, going back to the game analogy, these are tokens that are exchanged between parties, usually on an electronic exchange online, although they can do transactions privately, face-to-face, and simply hand one of the parties the numbers for the Bitcoin. You know, that's effectively how it occurs. That's all you have. You have these numbers that represent your ownership of a specific Bitcoin.
Well, but in a way, though, isn't all money kind of like that these days? I mean, at some level, isn't all money somewhat of a scam? I mean, isn't all sort of just belief?
Sure. In the modern age, yes. All fiat currencies are empty promises. The only difference is that the various states that sponsor these ersatz form of money force you to use them. That's what the fiat currency laws are and the legal tender laws. But in this case, what's intriguing about Bitcoin, and I think one of the key positive uses of it, is say you live in a country that's disrupted. Say you live in Lebanon. I have a good friend in Lebanon who's been in Bitcoin since day one. He uses Bitcoin to pay for many things. And he's also made a lot of money on the speculation. Hmm. You have to separate the two functions. So one is a private means of exchange where two parties can agree to exchange, say, goods for Bitcoin, right? The other aspect of this, though, is the fact that the price has been going up. Humans are irrational creatures. They chase the shiny object, especially if it's going up every day. So when you see your dentist or your doctor or your barber or whatever start to talk to you about Bitcoin, you know that we're in the midst of a mania, and that's the different, you know, aspect of it. So yes, are there uses for this? Of course, but there are uses that unfortunately also tend to attract illegal activities, terrorists, others who want to avoid the visible payment system, which is highly regulated.
Right.
You know, you can't send money around the world on SWIFT or the Fedwire or anything else without being a member of that network and without being validated as a member. In the world of Bitcoin, anybody can be a member.
Well, see, I mean, that's the thing that I keep thinking about. The roots of this thing are pretty shady, at least from my point of view. From what the first time I ever heard about Bitcoin, I was actually getting my tires changed in Dallas. I was sitting in a lobby reading a Time magazine article, and it was talking about the deep web and the dark web and Silk Road and Tor and Bitcoin. And I'd never heard of any of these things until just a few years ago. And, you know, it was pretty awful what I was hearing that people were using Bitcoin for on things like Silk Road. They were buying drugs, they were buying weapons, they were trading organs, you know, from children and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, when I remember reading it and thinking, that's revolting but fascinating. And I'm struck by the idea of just how, I mean, because as much of a game as this might be, as much of a fanciful idea as Bitcoin itself might be, people are now buying into it. So how do you actually convince people to buy into it? I mean, I could write, you know, Flintstones dollars.
What's fascinating about this phenomenon is that, you know, Satoshi Nakamoto or whoever did this wrote this opus, and it's kind of like he just left it out there on the kitchen counter, and somebody came in subsequently, read the paper, and said, wow, how cool. I'm going to trade this. And it took off all on its own. The participants have literally written the narrative themselves. There's no hype here. There's no consultants, you know, as apart from, say, blockchain, which is a whole other subject. But the Bitcoin marketplace literally took off on its own. And I think, to your point, the early adopters were those who wanted to avoid the formal network. That's the whole point. It got started with these very irregular uses, but now it's attracted what's largely a legitimate retail audience who are all intrigued by the fact that it's the single best performing asset in the world, even though it's a fraud. And so they're just dumping into it. But, you know, it's technology at work. It just shows you how powerful the internet and this technology is in terms of just, you know, blowing through national borders, blowing through regulatory constraints in a way that is a challenge to established states. Ultimately, Bitcoin is an interesting financial phenomenon, but really it's a political phenomenon. Because if it's allowed to exist, then it creates a parallel world where people can exchange value and not be subject to regulatory constraints, legal constraints, right, which is, to me, the most fascinating aspect of it.
Well, but can you actually change it in for real money? I mean, we hear about the Winklevoss twins. They're now billionaires in Bitcoin. So, I mean, can you walk into the airport exchange and
begin
with francs or something and say,
Well, here's the problem. A financial institution will not accept Bitcoin. It's not a commodity. It's not an asset. It's uncertain how you would even put it on a balance sheet in accounting terms, right? So what you have is a gaming instrument that does not easily plug into the established currency network. And what you have to do when you're selling it is you can sell it on an electronic exchange, but the size is very limited. Because in order for you to deliver, say you have a $10 million position in blockchain today, right? You've got to get somebody to wire transfer you $10 million in cash. And the protocols for doing this are negotiated. There's no established way of doing this. Each exchange has their own routine. And then, as I said before, you could have a private agreement with somebody off exchange, completely out of sight of anybody, where you say, I'm going to buy a car from you, you're going to give me X number of Bitcoin, right? And it's just a purely private transaction. So you can do it that way. But I think the point you raise is very important. There is no connection between the Bitcoin world and the world of dollars and yen and everything else in terms of making it easy. Bitcoin transactions are not easy because they're deliberately made inefficient for security.
Right.
So the whole thing was set up to be expensive and difficult. In fact, you know, about a year ago, the miner's reward was cut from 50 bitcoins to 25 for every transaction they validate, but the price went up. And indeed, everything about this marketplace is about a shrinking float, which is why the price goes up. There's no value here. We're not creating any value. There's no store of value. It's simply greater fools trading this thing amongst one another. So as long as it goes up, it'll be popular. But as soon as it goes down, the magic will be lost. And then that kind of dream state that everybody's in right now will be shattered, and we'll go back to what we were doing.
Well, one of the things about this is given this, I mean, you mentioned this earlier, the transactions, the encryptions, these require enormous amounts of energy to process.
Yep.
And because it keeps getting more complicated every time. So I keep wondering, is there a way to trace Bitcoin transactions? Because it almost sounds to me like one of those sort of thermal maps. Like if we dropped a nuclear bomb in the desert, Russian computers would see that we did it. You know, it would map that because there's a large sudden explosion of energy somewhere in the United States, and they would be able to see it. I have to wonder, because given the huge amounts of processing power that you need to solve these gigantic encryption math problems, is there not a way to trace, like, okay, there's a Bitcoin sale if you make it illegal? Would that be a way to find people using Bitcoin?
Well, some countries have banned it. As a practical matter, it's very difficult to stop people from trading it. You can certainly see the transactions that are part of the chain. But I don't know that governments really have the power, in a practical sense, to trace down transactions and associate a transaction with a beneficial owner. You know, there are some people out there who will report this on their taxes and say, yeah, I own X number of Bitcoin, and the value is, you know, whatever it is at year-end 2017. That's fine. And there are many others who won't. They're just going to treat this as completely off the grid. I don't know that governments have the ability to do that, but I can tell you that the tax authorities in the U.S. and the U.K., some other countries, have already been contacting all of the exchanges and asking the exchanges to provide them with information about the users.
Really?
So they can attack it that way. But again, going back to the original example, if you bought a Bitcoin from a vending machine in Beirut and you wrote the numbers down and put them away somewhere. There's really no way for anybody to track the fact that you did that transaction. They could see that you spent money on something, but whether or not they could get it down to the actual Bitcoin that you own, I don't think so. So there is some anonymity here.
Right.
But I also got to tell you that any organized entity inside the U.S., for example, that traffics in this stuff, I think has considerable liability, because eventually when it's shown that this is in fact a pretty plain vanilla kind of Ponzi scheme, anybody who was facilitating this activity, I think, could be facing some really serious consequences.
Well, what are your thoughts on the financial pros? I mean, I can see how people like myself, especially now, would look at this and think, oh, wow, if I just get some Bitcoin and I sit on it for a week, you know, it's going to be worth an extra $5,000 by, you know, I mean, I hesitate to put a cap on it now, because if I put a number on it now, by the time I'm finished this sentence, it might be worth more money, you know, so or worth more Bitcoin. But how do the financial pros, how do the people like the heavy hitters like Kevin O'Leary or Paul Graham, you know, or the Winklevoss twins or something, how are they being taken in by this too? Because they're all in. I mean, they think this is a great thing. I mean, what is the appeal for guys who should know better, I guess?
Well, I think, you know, greed is a powerful incentive. And when you see an opportunity like this to make double or triple digit returns in a short period of time, you know, I think it overwhelms people's good sense in many cases. It's the way speculation has always been. You see this in Asia a lot with stocks. You know, you'll have some stock that, you know, gets mentioned in a laundry room in Shanghai, and the next thing you know, it's taken off. And people have no idea why. They just heard the name.
Right.
And they go out and they buy it. It's very similar to the way stocks traded in the United States 100 years ago.
I was going to say, it sounds like a horse trade, or a horse race,
yeah.
I should say.
Well, the early days of investing in the U.S., kind of after World War One. When people were introduced to the war bonds during that conflict, they then started to get more and more involved in stocks. And many of these were not very good stocks, but they moved a lot. So, you know, I think that, you know, we have a futures contract from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, for Christ's sake. How did they decide to do this?
Right.
I've heard from a number of board members after they read my article, and they said, what is going on here, Chris? And I said, look, there's nothing new under the sun. We just have technology, and we have a very, I think, powerful narrative that's evolved all by itself, because people don't trust their banks. They don't trust government. They don't trust central banks. They've been watching quantitative easing for the past 7 years, and they're afraid of what they see. You know, I just got done with a luncheon with a bunch of managers, and many of them are piling back into gold, because they feel like when Bitcoin eventually collapses, you know, gold will take off. Who knows?
Well, you bring up a really good point there with this sort of people don't trust the banks or whatnot. And that's kind of been not to make anything political here, but that's been kind of a topic people have been talking about. One of the reasons Donald Trump won the presidency was because people just got tired of trusting government, and they put their faith in a total consummate disruptive outsider. You know,
yes.
And I never really stopped to think about that that's probably one of the good reasons why this thing is taken off, because it's just, who needs the system, because the system keeps screwing us over.
Well, there's that, you know, the underlying rate of inflation going back since the introduction of, you know, the Fed, for example, has been pretty stiff. It's impossible to look at the period from 1913 to today, about a century, and say that the Fed has done a good job in terms of price stability.
I think a lot of people would agree with you. Yeah.
they have facilitated the ability of the U.S. Treasury to issue debt and finance deficits. And a lot of people look at that and they believe that the dollar system, which has really existed since the end of World War II, is doomed because members of Congress cannot discipline themselves, which is a fair analysis. I mean, if you look at the numbers, eventually they're going to just have to hyperinflate out of the debt. And you see that around the world. So Bitcoin feeds on this concern. It feeds on this very legitimate fear. The problem is that this is not a substitute for a real currency, either as a means of exchange or as a short-term store of value. It's simply a speculative instrument. So it'll keep going up until it doesn't. And the thing about Bitcoin is that when you get up to that apex, And look at the charts, by the way. It's a hockey stick. It goes right up the side of the chart over the last 3 months. You look at that picture, and it tells you something, which is that this is not sustainable. You just can't go up anymore. But the problem is, much like the stock market, much like the real estate market in the U.S., there's a lack of supply. There's actually a shortage of Bitcoins. There's a funny story in the Wall Street Journal today about people who've lost their numbers. If you lose the hash, you've lost the Bitcoin. You can't recover it. There's no third party who can help you.
Do we know how many Bitcoins there are out there, and are there new ones being made? Or?
Well, there can only be 21 million. That's how the system is designed. It's like a Milton Friedman, perfect system. In other words, a central bank can't come in and make more Bitcoin. Each Bitcoin can be divided down to 1 millionth. So that's your total supply.
Wow.
That's it.
So there's this element of scarcity in the whole thing that's driving
this,
too.
And a lot of the float doesn't trade. The early trades in Bitcoin, say, you bought some 4 years ago, and you put the piece of paper, you put it somewhere, you don't know where it is anymore. So those Bitcoin are lost. They can't be traded.
Wow.
So the free float is less than the total outstanding Bitcoin, and there's no way to get them back.
And it's going to keep shrinking, I guess.
Well, no, the number of participants will keep growing until the novelty wears off, and then you'll see some really sharp down moves. Also, as the price has risen, the incentive for criminal elements, and indeed even governments, to go and try and steal Bitcoin is increasing. You know, we talked before about how expensive it is for the electricity to run the computers to solve these cryptographic puzzles to validate each trade. Well, if you're not paying for the electricity, say you're in North Korea or China or Russia, it's okay. You can go in there and start trying to hack the network and actually steal Bitcoin from legitimate players. You know what I'm saying? Because you're not held back by that cost element. And the Chinese, other people in Asia in particular, have already hacked the network. So the fact that you've seen all these retail investors jumping in the last month or two really worries me, because they don't appreciate where this came from and who were the original users of this network. These are not nice people, okay? They're not the sort of people that most hedge fund managers, for example, would want to associate with.
And I didn't hear about them the first time in an article about, the rosy future of economics.
Well, yeah. So, there are many elements to this that people don't understand. What they do understand is that the price is going up, and a lot of people are talking about it at cocktail parties.
Right.
And that's really driving the hype. But I'm glad the SEC took action.
Do you think there is a danger for the grid, considering all of the power? Because at some point, doesn't this just keep consuming more and more power to the point where it might need enough, so much power that we don't have enough to give it to, or is that just kind of being a sci-fi fantasy problem thing?
Well, you could never have broad adoption, first because of the limited number of Bitcoins, and second because of the amount of power it would require in computers. You're already seeing people stealing access to computers to use them to do computations to solve the proof of work for Bitcoin trades. So that tells you that we're already at a certain limit in terms of resources, computer power, electricity, etc. And yeah, over time, as it gets bigger, it is going to become a concern. You're going to be able to find these people. Like I say, if you're in a country where you actually have to pay for electricity, like Iceland is a great example, because their power is very cheap. They get it from geothermal energy. Right. So you have a lot of Bitcoin miners who have filled buildings up there that have slits in the roof so they can get the cold air in and cool off all the computers.
Right.
And these things run flat out until they fail. These computers are just sitting there doing very intensive math calculations. And just imagine that North Korea. The North Koreans are the key counterfeiters in the world. Bitcoin is perfect for them. They can throw a lot of computer power at it and make money. Same thing with the Chinese. So I think that, there is that element to it. But the real concern for me is the fact that so many retail investors have gotten involved in something which ultimately is a scam. This is classic fraud. And, but we've lost the ability, I think, to discern things like this. Our thinking is very muddled when it comes to finance, and that's why at the end of that article I quoted Jonathan Swift.
I like that. I did.
From the 1700s, how they used to punish fraud and Lilliput with death.
Right. Yeah. No, I like that. I was like, oh, nice use to Jonathan Swift there. Let me close out with this. Is there anything that would need to happen that would make you change your mind and wish you either would have invested in Bitcoin or that you see it becoming an actual thing that is not just some sort of parlor trick?
No, I think there'll be a derivative development, which is that the U.S. and the other major countries are going to have to come up with an electronic version of their own currencies. They kind of have it now, but they don't have it specific. In other words, you and I can do a wire transfer tomorrow, right?
Right.
But that wire transfer is not specific to the actual currency. It's just a notional amount that's transferred between the two of us. It's only when they hand you a physical dollar bill that has a serial number, right? And I think what you'll eventually move towards is some form of electronic currency that's actual legal tender, but which has also got an electronic identity that's separate from the physical dollar. And that may, you know, the rise of Bitcoin may actually accelerate that.
Author and financial advisor Chris Whalen of Whalen Global Advisors, LLC. Thank you, sir. I cannot thank you enough for being on the podcast and enlightening me about just what the hell Bitcoin actually is. Convo is a production of KETR-FM in Commerce, Texas. Production and logo design by Scott Morgan. Music by Eric the Ninja. Additional episodes of Convo are available at ketr.org. You can support this program and others like it by visiting ketr.org and clicking donate.